The following program, Issues, etc., is a repeat broadcast. Please do not attempt to call the program.
Greetings and welcome to Issues, etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for tuning us in. We are celebrating the resurrection of Jesus Christ this Easter Sunday. Christians all over the world celebrate the resurrection of Jesus Christ every Lord's Day. Did he really rise from the dead bodily? Did the same body that went into the tomb dead on Friday evening come out of the tomb alive Sunday morning? That's the question we're answering during this hour of Issues, etc. My guest, Dr. John Warwick Montgomery. There are other theories people have put forward. People have said he didn't really die. He just woke up after a very gruesome torture. He swooned and then revived. Others say, no, the disciples merely hallucinated that their master, their teacher, was alive again. Some say it was an impostor who encountered the disciples Easter evening in the upper room. We'll answer all of those false theories against the resurrection of Jesus Christ during this hour as well. My guest during this hour, Dr. John Warwick Montgomery, is a regular guest here on Issues, etc. He's Professor Emeritus at the University of Luton in England, Barrister at Law in England and Wales, and member of the Bar of the Supreme Court of the United States. He's Distinguished Professor of Apologetics and the History of Christian Thought at Trinity College and Theological Seminary in Newburgh, Indiana, and author and editor of 50 books, including Human Rights and Human Dignity. Dr. Montgomery, welcome back to Issues, etc.
A great pleasure as always.
Dr. Montgomery, we're in a court of law. I would like you as a lawyer to make the orthodox Christian case on the basis of the evidence for the bodily resurrection of Jesus Christ.
All right. Ladies and gentlemen of the jury, the question that we have to face is a very simple one. On Easter morning, did Jesus Christ, who had been crucified 3 days earlier, rise again from the dead? Now, we mustn't make this more complicated than it is. The problem is not a matter of knowing what a miracle is or being able to define a resurrection. None of us have had contact with such things, and therefore we're certainly not in a position to provide definitions. But that doesn't mean that it isn't possible to make this case and to make it powerfully. What actually are we talking about? We're talking about a person who was dead at point A and alive again at point B. Now, that isn't within our experience, but we've known plenty of instances where people were alive at point A and dead at point B. And we're able to make a distinction between these two conditions. If we weren't able to decide whether people were dead or alive, we'd be burying the wrong people. The fact is that all the way through history, it's been reasonably possible to decide whether somebody is dead or alive. So in order to determine whether Jesus rose again from the dead, all we have to do, ladies and gentlemen of the jury, is to determine whether Jesus in fact was dead at point A when he was crucified, and whether he was alive again at point B on Easter morning. Now, we know from first-hand, primary source testimony that Jesus was crucified by a Roman crucifixion team, and they certainly knew their business. They had done a lot of crucifixions. And the account tells us that they even ran a sword into his side to make sure that he was dead. There is strong medical evidence of this. As a matter of fact, one of the critical articles on this subject, published in the Journal of the American Medical Association, the JAMA, concluded that Jesus was absolutely dead. The cardiac sac around the heart had been punctured. Out came blood and water, that is, blood and lymph. All right, he was dead at point A. Was he alive at point B? Well, here we have firsthand testimonies to the effect that he was physically alive, so physically alive that he ate with his disciples. One of them was able to thrust his hand physically into the nail prints in his hands and into his side. Paul, writing in 56 AD, within a generation of these events, says that he appeared to over 500 people, most of whom were alive to the present. And he says that these things were not done in a corner. None of the people who desperately wanted to refute this ever did so. And they had the means, the motive, and the opportunity. Surely the Jewish religious leaders who had brought about his crucifixion wouldn't have stood by and allowed this story to go out if there were any kind of serious evidence against it.
Dr.
The conclusion that we come to is that Jesus did rise from the dead. Any other explanation falls to the ground. The only other possible explanations would be that either the Romans or the Jews stole the body. That was against their interest. They wouldn't have done that. And the disciples certainly wouldn't have stolen the body and then gone out and claimed that Jesus rose again from the dead. They would have then died for something they knew to be untrue. People have died through history for things that they thought were true and weren't, but people don't go around dying for things that they know perfectly well are false. And finally, ladies and gentlemen of the jury, the burden of proof rests on the opposition to show that he didn't rise from the dead, because all of the positive testimony favors his resurrection. So if that testimony is the only testimony, it needs to be accepted. And we leave it to the other side to provide any kind of first-hand primary evidence that Jesus did not rise from the dead.
Dr. Montgomery, how important is it that there are eyewitnesses, reliable eyewitnesses, to Jesus being alive after being dead?
Well, that's absolutely critical, because not only in a court of law, but in any kind of serious historical scholarship, the case for an event is going to depend upon whether we have the testimony of witnesses who are actually there and who are reliable and whom we can trust.
What about, you mentioned this towards the end there just a few minutes ago, the fact that if he were not alive, that should be rather simple to falsify any claim of resurrection. How would one provide that kind of evidence to falsify the resurrection? What kind of evidence would suffice?
Well, all it would require is producing the body. You know, this is a kind of classic missing body issue. It's the sort of thing that detective story writers have dealt with, Agatha Christie and the like. The opponents, all they had to do was to show that the body was still there. And yet that's precisely what they were not able to do. And as we've already indicated, to argue that any of the interest groups in the situation stole that body is ridiculous. It's either against their interest, in the case of the Romans and the Jews, or it's the kind of thing that nobody would possibly do, go out and proclaim a resurrection when they knew it wasn't the case.
So insofar as the evidence is concerned, this really is no different than if, say, someone were to die today. When the family arrived at the funeral home director says, "I do not know where the body is. It's gone." And then the family later would say, "We've seen this person alive. He's actually come and seen us." And if someone were to bring such a case before you, you'd be asking for precisely the same kind of evidence, right?
Yes, exactly. There's a further consideration, though, in the case of Jesus, and that is that he was in a hostile environment in which there were many people who very definitely would have refuted this had they been able to. That's how this differs a bit from your analogy. This is a situation, in the case of Jesus, where we've got the functional equivalent of cross-examination. F.F. Bruce, the great New Testament scholar at the University of Manchester, said that the presence of hostile witnesses in that situation, in the case of Jesus, was the sort of thing that, in a sense, goes on in a courtroom where you've got someone who is strongly motivated to refute the position and who goes after the witnesses. That certainly must have taken place in the instance of the apostolic testimony, because we know that the witnesses to the resurrection preached the gospel first in the synagogues. They went first to the Jew and later to the Gentile. And my goodness, that was going into the lion's mouth. because the leaders of the Jewish religious community were precisely the people who were present at the high Passover season in Jerusalem when all of this took place, and they were the people who had the most to lose in the face of the resurrection of Christ, and who desperately wanted to get rid of the whole thing.
With only a minute to answer this before our break, Dr. Montgomery, there are also personal claims and promises which Jesus himself attaches to the fact of his resurrection, aren't there?
Yes, and the resurrection mustn't be regarded just as a historical question. The fact of the matter is that the resurrection is the evidence that Jesus was exactly the person he claimed to be, and he makes that resurrection available to all of us. He says, I am the resurrection and the life, and if any man comes to me, he will never die.
My guest is Dr. John Warwick Montgomery. When we come back from this break, we are going to start answering some of the objections to the bodily resurrection of Jesus Christ. There are many alternate theories for what really happened when a man dead at point B, at point A, is appearing to be alive at point B. We'll start with the swoon theory, or it's called the swoon and resuscitation theory, when we come back from this break. Dr. John Warwick Montgomery is Professor Emeritus at the University of Luton in England, Barrister at Law in England and Wales, and member of the Bar of the Supreme Court of the United States. He also has authored and edited 50 books, including Human Rights and Human Dignity, and he's Distinguished Professor of Apologetics and the History of Christian Thought at Trinity College and Theological Seminary in Newburgh, Indiana. We'll be right back right after this.
Talk radio for the thinking Christian. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
When your children ask you about the very first Easter, how do you go about telling them the story of Jesus' passion, death, and resurrection from the dead? What was it like to witness his suffering, his trials, and his crucifixion? These events stand at the very heart of the Christian faith, and they are beautifully retold in the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for April, The Very First Easter, by Dr. Paul Meyer. You can order The Very First Easter by calling Concordia Publishing House weekdays during regular business hours, 1-800-325-3040, 1-800-325-3040. Or you can order The Very First Easter online at our website, issuesetc.org. Under the What's New section, you'll find information on The Very First Easter. It's the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for April. 1-800-325-3040. Welcome back to Issues Etc. We're talking about the bodily resurrection of Jesus. We're ready to take on some of the alternate theories for what may have happened Easter morning. Next week on Issues Etc., we're going to study a Lord's Supper hymn written by Thomas Aquinas called Now My Tongue, The Mystery Telling, with Dr. Norman Nagel of Concordia Seminary in St. Louis. The broadcast will also feature a live in-studio performance by the Concordia Seminary Chorus. Is the Lord's Supper something that we do for God, or is it something that God does for us? Do we really receive the body and blood of Christ in this sacrament? We'll talk about it next week on Issues Etc. with Dr. Norman Nagel. Now, if you have a question or a comment on the Lord's Supper, post it this week, and we'll try to have our guest respond next Sunday during the program. All you have to do to post a question or a comment is go to our website at issuesetc.org, click on the What's New section, and there you'll find a link to our Issues Etc. forum. There you can post a question or a comment. The website address again, issuesetc.org. Dr. Montgomery, let's go first to what is probably the most common sense alternate theory for what happened, and that is called the swoon and resuscitation theory. I think it goes something like this. Jesus didn't die. They took him down off the cross, supposing him to be dead, but he was merely comatose or had swooned from all the torture and the crucifixion. They placed him in the tomb, but later he revived from this, made his way out, and appeared to his disciples, claiming to have risen from the dead. How do you take on that?
Well, if anyone can believe that, they shouldn't have the least trouble believing the resurrection. That theory requires far more faith, really credulity, than to hold to the resurrection itself, because it goes directly in the face of the witnesses, and it goes directly in the face of Jesus' character, and it leaves far more unanswered questions than it provides answers to. First of all, as we've said, Roman crucifixion teams knew their business. They had lots of practice, and the account makes perfectly clear that in the case of Jesus, they were not taking any chances. Normally, all that a team did was to allow the person to die on the cross, even though this took hours and hours and hideous agony. They would break the knees, that sort of thing, to speed the thing up, but they wouldn't go to the extent of thrusting a lance into the individual's side. In Jesus' case, they did that to be certain that he was dead. Secondly, if this theory were correct, that would mean that Jesus, having gone through an experience which killed everybody else, somehow managed to survive this. Now, what kind of condition would he have been in? Could he possibly have been in condition to walk the road to Emmaus, to have eaten with his disciples, to have carried on for a period of, 40 days or whatever, giving people the impression that he was perfectly all right? I mean, this is utterly absurd. And this goes totally against his moral character. To do this would have been to deceive people. And Jesus said that people who were lying were of their father the devil. He was a liar from the beginning. Jesus would not have done this kind of thing. And finally, if you take this view, what then happened to him, for goodness sake? Did he go to a summer resort on the Black Sea? Did he retire? I mean, there is no explanation whatsoever as to what happened to him subsequently. So you've got a missing body in the situation in any case. This theory, which was propounded by a lame-brained German rationalist by the name of Venturini in the 18th century, is about the dumbest way of handling the problem that one has ever come across.
There's also the account in Mark 15, near the end of the chapter, about hostile agents, namely the men of Pilate at the bequest of Joseph of Arimathea, verifying the death of Christ. What is that about?
Yes, Joseph of Arimathea asked for the body so that it could be buried appropriately, and that offered still another opportunity to be certain that he was dead. When the body was put into the hands of a third party and also was prepared for burial in the ordinary Jewish fashion, the chances of the individual being still alive are just nil.
One more question on this theory. The Romans certainly were not amateurs at crucifixion. They were as close as you can come to professionals at killing people by crucifixion, weren't they?
Oh, yes, this is true. They were the equivalent of le docteur Guillotin at the time of the French Revolution. I mean, people did not escape from this sort of thing.
Here's another theory. Someone will say, Dr. Montgomery, this all sounds quite unlikely. Isn't it far more likely that the disciples, begrieved, disappointed, beyond belief, having all their hopes shattered and destroyed, that their master and the person that they had put all their hopes in was now dead, simply out of grief, hallucinated, individually and corporately, that Jesus had come back to life?
Well, that theory has recently been presented by Gerd Ludemann, a member of the Jesus Seminar. I debated him on BBC television 3 or 4 years ago on a major program on Sunday night, and Ludemann at that point considered himself still a Christian, even though he didn't believe in the resurrection. He has since given up Christianity completely, though he still has a theological chair at a German university. Yes, shows a certain weakness of mind on the part of the Germans. But in any case, the trouble with this argument is that mass hallucinations just don't take place. You can engage in a hypnotic influence upon gullible individuals on a one-to-one basis, but the idea of claiming that there was a mass hallucination which would have made it possible for a number of individuals all to provide very concrete and specific narratives as to their contact with the risen Christ is just out of the question. I mean, we have, for example, the account of Jesus eating with his disciples in connection with the road to Emmaus, and he brings out the details of the scriptures to them, and they recognize him. You've got the Doubting Thomas incident where Thomas will not believe what he has heard from the other reliable disciples, and Jesus appears and makes it possible for him to check this out in terms of Jesus' physical body. This sort of thing is not the material of hallucination. Hallucination, religiously, is always vague. You have the sun sort of whirling around, and you have this sort of a wispy, ethereal vision, maybe of the Virgin Mary, and what comes out of this is platitudes such as be nice to everybody and God loves you and that sort of thing. You don't at all have the high degree of specificity which exists in the case of the resurrection accounts. Incidentally, Ludemann got to this position, he said, after his father passed away, and in the night subsequent to that, a few days later, Ludemann dreams that his father is there before him. And Ludemann concludes from this that that's how you can explain the resurrection of Christ. I mean, the two things have nothing to do with each other.
Dr. John Warwick Montgomery is my guest. He is the editor and author of 50 books, including Human Rights and Human Dignity. You can purchase Dr. John Warwick Montgomery's book, Human Rights and Human Dignity, directly through our radio program. We'll send you the book for a contribution of $30 to Issues, Etc. The price does include shipping and handling. Simply have your MasterCard, your Visa, or your Discover card ready and call the Issues, Etc. resource line at 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. The book you asked for is called Human Rights and Human Dignity by Dr. John Warwick Montgomery. The number again, 1-800-737-0172. When we come back from this break, we're going to take on another theory in opposition to the bodily resurrection of Jesus Christ. It's called the impersonation theory. We'll be right back. Children love stories, especially stories that are true. The greatest story you can tell your children is found in the Issues, Etc. book of the month for April called The Very First Easter. In this book, Dr. Paul Meyer vividly retells the story of Jesus' betrayal, his passion, his trials, his crucifixion, and his resurrection. It's the Issues, Etc. book of the month for April, The Very First Easter. You can order this book online at our website, issuesetc.org. Under the What's New section, you'll find information on the very first Easter. You can also order the book by calling Concordia Publishing House weekdays during regular business hours, 1-800-325-3040, 1-800-325-3040, or go to our website, issuesetc.org, issuesetc.org.
The radio voice of the Lutheran faith for the 21st century. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
Before his crucifixion, why was Jesus tried before the Jewish council, the Jewish king, and the Roman governor? The story of Jesus' passion, crucifixion, and resurrection is beautifully retold and illustrated in our new Issues, Etc. book of the month for April, The Very First Easter, by Dr. Paul Meyer. You can order The Very First Easter online. Go to our website at issuesetc.org. Under the What's New section, you'll find information on how to order this book, issuesetc.org, or call Concordia Publishing House weekdays during regular business hours, 1-800-325-3040. When you write or call, be sure to ask for the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for April, the very first Easter, 1-800-325-3040, or order the book online at issuesetc.org.
This is Family News in Focus. I'm Bob Dittmer. A magazine ad has touched off a confrontation within the United Methodist Church. A group of over 100 Methodist leaders, including seven bishops, ran the ad in Christian Century magazine criticizing President Bush. Terry Phillips tells us about their complaints.
It's a full-page open letter to the president, generally indicting him as a bad Christian and a bad Methodist and calling on him to repent.
These people do not speak for the United Methodist Church.
That's Dr. Ira Galloway, a longtime leader in Methodist ministries. He questions the audacity of the six retired bishops who lent their names to the ad.
By what presumption do they think they have the right to make decisions which would and appear to be speaking for the church on matters of political, economic, and social theory?
James Heidinger, who heads the Methodist ministry Good News, says the message is off base as well.
It really is in no way representative of the church. And this looks a bit like a temper tantrum.
The letter charges Mr. Bush with threatening the earth and contributing to the forces of wickedness. Mark Tooley, a Methodist and a veteran watcher of his church for the Institute of Religion and Democracy, says the attack is based in the politics of the attackers.
The major theological problem here is they're measuring Bush's Christian faith not by what he believes about Jesus Christ, but by what his politics are.
Tooley describes the signers as 60s anti-war activists. Galloway characterizes them this way.
There's a sense in which you might say they're the radical Methodist fringe of the Democratic Party.
Our calls to Joseph Sprague, the active bishop among those who signed the letter, were not returned. For Family News and Focus, I'm Terry Phillips.
Some of those whose names appear in the ad are also associated with opposing United Methodist Church doctrine by challenging the deity of Christ and supporting same-sex marriage. For Family News in Focus, I'm Bob Dittmer.
AM 850 KFUO has a great way for you to get the word out about your church. Become an AM 850 KFUO Church of the Week. In exchange for a financial gift, your congregation has 35 personalized messages throughout the week. That's five a day. We also recognize your congregation once an hour as the Church of the Week, and your pastor is featured on the morning show. For more information, contact Janelle Flerke at 1-888-930-4438.
Is the death and resurrection of Christ historically reliable? Find out with the new children's book, The Very First Easter, published by Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040. The Very First Easter is the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for April, 1-800-325-3040. You can find out more about this book on the internet, issuesetc.org, and click What's New? The Very First Easter by Dr. Paul Meyer, our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for April.
Folks, we've been recording this hour with Dr. John Warwick Montgomery on the evidence of the resurrection. However, we will be live this next hour taking your questions and comments on the issue of answering theories against the bodily resurrection of Christ. Our guest will be Dr. Montgomery's colleague, Craig Parton. So call us in the next hour at 1-800-730-2727. That's 1-800-730-2727. Or you can also email us with a question or comment at issuesetc@kfuo.org. That's issuesetc@kfuo.org. Anyone who calls in or emails us with a question or a comment during this show will receive a two-taped series on answering the theories against the bodily resurrection of Christ. So call us at 1-800-730-2727 or email us at issuesetc@kfuo.org. We will be live in the next hour, Easter Sunday evening, 1-800-730-2727, or our email address, issuesetc@kfuo.org. My guest in this hour, Dr. John Warwick Montgomery. The next theory, Dr. Montgomery, is one that seems to have some little evidence in the biblical accounts, and that is when Jesus supposedly appeared to his disciples and others, especially nearer to the time of the supposed resurrection, they often did not recognize him at first or even at all. And this has had led some to suppose that this was not Jesus, in fact, but someone impersonating Jesus. How do you handle that one?
Well, if they had never been sure that it was Jesus, that would be one thing. But it's a situation where, at first, they were, as it were, blinded by this thing, and very soon thereafter recognized Jesus, identified him with absolutely no difficulties whatsoever. I mean, one has to realize that the resurrection meant a change in Jesus. He was less a human than he had been before, but his divine nature was far more manifest than it had ever been previously. It was even more manifest than when the transfiguration occurred. So you should expect some kind of difficulty on the part of ordinary human beings in facing him under those conditions. But the fact is that every one of the accounts makes clear that those who experienced this very, very quickly identified him and identified him clearly. You know, there's been a lot of work done on eyewitness identification in the courts because, of course, so much depends upon being able to identify the person that one saw doing the robbery, that sort of thing. Elizabeth Loftus is probably the greatest specialist in this, and there is a work that's been done fairly recently entitled Eyewitness Testimony Strategies and Tactics. Arnolds, Carroll, and Lewis, and Seng have done this composite work. And at one point in this, they say this, and I'm quoting exactly, the better acquainted a witness is with a subject, the more likely it is that the witness's identification will be accurate. And in an eyewitness context, the greatest challenge to the advocate's power of persuasion is presented by the attempt to argue, without support from expert testimony, the unreliability of an unimpeached eyewitness identification of a prior acquaintance. Now, here we have an unimpeached eyewitness identification on the part of a number of different people of a prior acquaintance, someone with whom they had had intimate contact over a three-year period. Under those conditions, mistaken identity drops virtually to nil. Mistaken identity occurs in situations where you didn't have contact with the individual previously, and therefore it is very difficult often to remember the exact features and to distinguish one person from another. That's not in the least what we have here in the case of Jesus' resurrection appearances.
Well, there are those who would counter this by saying, again, these people were grief-stricken, disappointed, wanting, hoping against hope, to believe that what Christ had promised he would do, he would do. Couldn't a wily impersonator had made himself up with some fake scars or whatnot, self-imposed wounds, and claimed to be Christ?
Well, that, of course, is entirely speculative. And in courts of law and in historical scholarship, we don't rely on possibility because, as one philosopher has said, anything is possible but squeezing toothpaste back into a tube. I mean, since anything is possible, then, of course, one can hypothesize all sorts of things. But what's that got to do with arriving at any decent conclusions? We base, in history and in law, our conclusions on plausibility, probability, and that means on the basis of actual evidence. You know, when a judge instructs a jury in a criminal case, the judge will say, you've got to find this person innocent unless you are convinced to a moral certainty beyond reasonable doubt of his guilt. And being convinced to a moral certainty beyond reasonable doubt means according to the evidence that has been admitted and presented to you in this case. You must not speculate. You must stick with exactly what the evidence is. And if on the basis of that evidence you could find any alternative explanation for the crime other than that the defendant did it, you've got to find him innocent. But if not, you've got to find him guilty. Now, when facing an issue like the resurrection of Christ, we can't engage in, the Fandanican chariots of the gods type of explanation that maybe, Jesus was cleverly disguised, a space person cleverly disguised in a Jesus suit, or that, you know, they were people making themselves up to look like Jesus to console poor, wretched, disappointed disciples. I mean, all of that is really not worthy of rational discussion.
Okay, there are a few other kind of hard fact refutations that people have attempted against the bodily resurrection of Jesus. One of them is simply that the body was stolen, and the rest was made up. The disciples never really saw him raised from the dead. What they did, or others may have done, was simply steal the body out of the tomb, and then they could claim, he's risen indeed.
Yeah, well, one has to have some ideas who would do a thing like this. And if the idea is that, what, there was an itinerant body snatcher around who managed this, that's, again, the kind of ridiculous speculation that we were just discussing. There are only three interest groups in this situation, only three: the Romans, the Jewish religious leaders, and the disciples. They are the three groups that had a role to play in this whole thing. And therefore, they are the only suspects, one might say, in the determination of a question like this. Now, the Romans are not going to engage in body snatching. That's not why they expanded their empire into Palestine or into other parts of the world. They were there in order to keep things quiet, and they wanted to keep things quiet in order to collect taxes. This was a matter of a ruling empire, and they were pragmatists. The reason that Pilate turned Jesus over to the crowd and let Barabbas go was not that he thought that Jesus was guilty. It was that this was a bureaucratic, administrative thing to do to keep things quiet and keep people happy. Now, under those circumstances, he is absolutely not going to authorize the stealing of a body, nor are any Roman soldiers going to do this. As far as the Jewish religious leaders are concerned, they are absolutely the last people on the face of the earth that would have stolen the body. It was utterly against their interest. They're the ones who went to Pilate and said, put a guard on the tomb. We don't even want a rumor to start that he's risen from the dead, because they knew that that would hurt them. Now, that leaves only the disciples. And as we've said, disciples are not going to steal a body and then go out and die for something they know to be untrue. Incidentally, a philosopher, an atheistic philosopher, some years ago, hypothesized along the following line. He said, that would be a psychological miracle if they had done such a thing. I prefer that psychological miracle to the biological miracle of Jesus actually rising again from the dead. Well, of course, this isn't a matter of choosing between psychological and biological miracles. But even if it were, there's no evidence of a psychological miracle. The disciples were sane and sober, and there's no evidence whatsoever that they would do a thing like this. But there's plenty of evidence in favor of the biological miracle of the resurrection. And if we're going to go with evidence instead of speculation, then we're certainly going to reject the body-snatching theories.
It's also even dealt with in the scriptural text, isn't it? I'm thinking about Matthew 28, verses 11 through 15, where the guard who witnessed the resurrection, the guards who witnessed the resurrection, are bribed by the chief priests and the elders to say that someone came and stole the body.
Yes, and it seems highly unlikely that that would have been put in to a narrative by the disciples or by the writers of the New Testament themselves. Because that would, it suggested some alternative possibility.
Now, there's another one. I want to deal with this after the break, and it's a similar kind of tomb-oriented theory, and it's this. Jesus was simply not buried the way that the scriptures say he was. He was taken down off the cross and thrown into a mass grave. The disciples were not privy to the place where he was interned in this way. And so it's called the unknown tomb theory. Or maybe he was put into a tomb and the disciples never knew exactly where he was. Therefore, they could claim later, well, there's no body. The tomb was empty because no one really knows where Jesus was buried in the first place. We'll deal with that particular theory after the break. My guest, as we are answering some of the arguments against the bodily resurrection of Jesus, is Dr. John Warwick Montgomery. He's Professor Emeritus at the University of Luton in England, Barrister at Law in England and Wales, and member of the Bar of the Supreme Court of the United States, Distinguished Professor of Apologetics and the History of Christian Thought at Trinity College and Theological Seminary in Newburgh, Indiana, and author and editor of 50 books, including Human Rights and Human Dignity. Now, you can read a chapter from Dr. Montgomery's book, Human Rights and Human Dignity, right there on the internet. The chapter is titled, The Jury Returns, A Juridical Defense of Christianity. Go to our website at issuesetc.org under the section titled, What's New? You'll find this chapter called A Juridical Defense of Christianity, The Jury Returns, right there at the website, issuesetc.org, under the What's New section. When we come back, what about the unknown tomb? Could it be that the place of Jesus' burial was unknown to all but a few, and that the disciples, taking opportunity, not knowing the whereabouts of his burial, simply said, he's risen from the dead? And no one could refute it, because no one knew where he might be buried. We'll be right back with Dr. John Warwick Montgomery to answer that theory.
A voice in the wilderness of American evangelicalism. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
International human rights attorney and law professor Dr. John Warwick Montgomery on the importance of Issues, Etc.
Before settling in England and France, I had my own Christian radio program for 10 years in California and 2 years in Washington State. I was also a regular for over a decade on national religious television. In a word, I have had a great deal of contact with evangelical programming, both good and bad, and my judgment in this area is probably worth something. In my opinion, Issues Etc. is one of the very few programs on Christian radio willing to discuss tough questions with solid theological answers. I consider it a great privilege to be able to appear on the program regularly, and I commend it to every serious listener.
You can support the worldwide outreach of Issues Etc. by making a tax-deductible gift this week. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri, 63117. Or you can make a credit card donation by calling our resource line at 1-800-737-0172.
Our guest, Dr. John Warwick Montgomery, is director and professor in residence for the International Academy of Apologetics, Evangelism, and Human Rights. It's held annually in Strasbourg, France. Now, the Academy is full for this year, so you might want to register early for next year's Academy. Now, if you'd like a free information brochure on the 6th Annual European Summer Study of the International Academy of Apologetics, Evangelism, and Human Rights, simply call our resource line, 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. We'll send you a free brochure, or you can check out our website at issuesetc.org under that section titled What's New. You'll find information on this academy. Don't wait and don't miss out on next year's academy. 1-800-737-0172. Before the break, Dr. Montgomery, I outlined what's commonly known as the unknown tomb theory, that Jesus was buried either in a mass grave or some unknown location, and the disciples there had ignorance on their side when they claimed he had risen from the dead. How do you refute it?
Well, first of all, the events of Jesus last week, the trial, the crucifixion, and all of that were central to what was going on in Jerusalem. It was the high season of the Passover. All of the people who had important administrative roles in the Jewish community were involved in this kind of thing. And to imagine that following the crucifixion, the body would in effect have been lost is really an unlikely scenario. Surely there were enough people who were interested in this, not just the disciples, the women, for example, who were very concerned about having a proper Jewish burial given to Jesus, and all of his friends and those who had been influenced by him, and then all of the hostile crowd, the hostile religious leaders and the like, who wanted to make sure that nothing untoward occurred. Under those circumstances, it seems entirely inadmissible to try to argue that the body was just lost. But then beyond that, this explanation requires that the disciples lie concerning the post-resurrection appearances. And, you know, people in law and people treated by historians are supposed to be innocent until proven guilty. And there's not a bit of evidence in these primary source documents that the disciples would ever do a thing like this. They are, some of them, very simple, straightforward people. Others are firm in the expression of their own morality. They were clearly very much impacted by Jesus' teaching, and as we've already seen, Jesus was dead against lying. He considered lying to be demonic. So if you put these two considerations together, the public nature of everything that occurred and the moral character of the disciples, that theory doesn't work either.
Okay, up to this point we have dealt with more or less physical theories, dealing with the physical elements of the evidence here, or perhaps the state of mind of the disciples. There is one last theory put forth against the bodily resurrection of Jesus, which is somewhat metaphysical, and it simply says that the resurrection was not bodily done, it was a spiritual resurrection. The body remained in the tomb, but his spirit rose and appeared in some form here and there to his disciples. How would you refute that one, Dr. Montgomery?
Well, that's a theory that has been presented by liberal theologians very largely, and of course the basis of this theory is their anti-miraculous presuppositions. They don't want to say anything about Jesus' resurrection which would commit them to a physical miracle. You know, liberals have always taken the view in reference to secularism, if you can't beat them, join them. And so they think that by taking this kind of an approach, their presentation will be more palatable to secularists and unbelievers. Fact of the matter is that such a ridiculous viewpoint that it doesn't appeal to anybody and certainly isn't going to attract secular interest, because everything that we have in the record speaks of the resurrection as bodily. Now, it's true that Paul talks about a spiritual body involved in this, but that doesn't mean it's not a body also in physical terms. The fact that Jesus walked through walls and doors and that sort of thing simply indicates that his divine nature was far more on display after the resurrection than it had been previously, and he had characteristics that went beyond that of a human body. But he ate with his disciples. The account says that Thomas was able to thrust his hand into his physical side. And he ascended bodily into heaven. In the same way as you see him go into heaven, he will return from heaven. All of this means that if one wants to take the account seriously, one has got to take the bodily resurrection seriously. That doesn't remove from its spiritual quality at all. What it does is to make it a concrete reality. And it says that this is something that is impactive on the human condition. And it says that at the end of time we'll be resurrected bodily as well. You know, Christianity is not a sort of ethereal dream for spiritual speculation. Christianity happens to speak to the real conditions on earth, and the transformation that we're going to undergo eventually will be similar to that of Jesus himself, and that means that there'll be a physical restoration of ourselves. That ought to be something of tremendous consequence to every one of us.
Dr. Montgomery, let's return again to the court of law. I would like to hear your closing arguments, your best evidence, after we've looked at these alternate theories for the bodily resurrection of Jesus Christ. You have about 1 minute.
Yes. Ladies and gentlemen of the jury, we've seen that there is no significant argument against the resurrection, and we've noted that the burden of proof rests upon those who would want to refute it. So, what we have is overwhelming evidence that this man, Jesus, who claimed to be God and predicted his resurrection, actually did rise again from the dead. My question to you is, what possible motive could anyone have for not accepting this? What do you get if you deny the resurrection of Jesus Christ? All you get is a bleak secular landscape in which you're going to die and you're going to stay dead. But the resurrection of Christ says that it's not that at all. The fact of the matter is that life does have an eternal purpose, and Jesus says that he is the resurrection and the life, and he can guarantee that you're going to live again yourself. Now, there is no possible advantage to denying this. If you deny it, you're going against the evidence, and you're losing the opportunity for an eternal fellowship with him. So, what there is here is every reason to accept it and no reason to deny it. And therefore, I expect that any intelligent person is going to reach a proper verdict in this area.
Dr. John Warwick Montgomery, thank you very much for your time. Thanks for being our guest on Issues, Etc.
A great pleasure.
Dr. John Warwick Montgomery is Professor Emeritus at the University of Luton in England. He's Barrister at Law in England and Wales and member of the Bar of the Supreme Court of the United States, Distinguished Professor of Apologetics and the History of Christian Thought at Trinity College and Theological Seminary in Newburgh, Indiana, and author and editor of 50 books, including Human Rights and Human Dignity. Folks, if you'd like to receive our two-part tape series on answering theories against the bodily resurrection of Jesus for free, all you have to do is call in or email us in the next hour with a question or a comment. Now, your question or comment must deal with these theories against Christ's resurrection or one of your own. Join us next hour to take, we'll take your phone calls and your emails, and we'll be with Dr. Montgomery's colleague, Craig Parton. So call us in the next hour, 1-800-730-2727. That's 1-800-730-2727. You can also email us with a question or comment, issuesetc@kfuo.org. That's issuesetc@kfuo.org. We'll be here in studio next hour, Easter Sunday evening. Our phone number, 1-800-730-2727. Our email address, issuesetc@kfuo.org. Atheists, agnostics, skeptics of all types will get top priority in the next hour for their questions and their comments. You can also listen to the next hour's broadcast on the internet. Simply go to our website at issuesetc.org and click on the worldwide KFUO logo, issuesetc.org. Folks, here is the bottom line. There are personal claims and promises attached to the fact of Jesus' resurrection. If he did not rise from the dead as he promised he would, he wasn't who he said he was. And he didn't accomplish what he promised he would accomplish. What did he accomplish? Why did he die in the first place? Because our sin and his obedience to the law required it. Our disobedience, our sin, made it necessary that God sacrifice his own son for us. And Jesus' perfect obedience to that law culminated in his death on the cross. But his obedience didn't go only that far. It was also out of obedience for us on our behalf that he rose again to assure us of salvation in his name, crucified and risen from the dead. Jesus Christ has risen. He has risen indeed.
Listen to Pastor Todd Wilkin weekly on Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues Etc. to continue. Our address is Issues Etc., Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri, 63117. Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri, 63117. Visit us on the World Wide Web at www.issuesetc.org. That's issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. 1-800-737-0172. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.